to Chinese TV. Inspiring people across the planet to be a little kinder and a little more gentle with each other. Delivering inspirational TV, one story at a time, from my lounge to yours. I'm your host, Tony Lontis. Good evening, America, and good midday to those Australians listening. And we've had one of those mornings with a few technical difficulties. And so without further ado, I'm going to introduce you to the amazing Elliot Connor. So Elliot is the founder and CEO of Human Nature Products, and an international environmental charity supporting volunteers across 104 countries. He's a TED speaker, author, podcast host, and filmmaker with the goal of reframing our human relationship with nature. So he's saving people and the planet, and he's all of 17 years old. Hello, Connor. Hello, Elliot.
Hi there. It's great to be on the show.
Oh, my goodness. We've already done one interview today.
Yes.
And I'm so glad that we've finally managed to get through all the technological hassles and have you live on the phone versus live on Zoom, which is fine. So, Elliot, you're 17 years old. You're in the middle of your senior grade at school. How does a 17-year-old start their own charity?
Oh, immense difficulty, I think one could safely say. I remember thinking back 12 odd months, just slightly over perhaps, when I started Human Nature Projects. It was a lot of work at first. I think the systems are not equipped, not designed to support 17-year-olds, minors wanting to start up their own social venture. So, yeah, there were a few hiccups, a few complications to start off with. But thankfully, I managed to get through it all. I've been really lucky to be supported by some amazing people, some wonderful mentors, and eventually managed to work out how the whole system works. Registered as a charity, obviously, and now I've been running just over a year. So it's been wonderful to see how Human Nature Projects has evolved as an organisation. As you mentioned, we're now well across the world, so 104 yes. odd countries with chapters, with volunteers, with national teams in, which is quite incredible as a conservation community, really trying to build up a network across the globe.
Fantastic. So, Elliot, can we talk about some of those mentors that have helped you along the way, and how have they helped you be in business at such a young age?
Yeah, certainly. So I've been, as I mentioned, very lucky with the support I've received. A few come to mind. So early on, when I was getting into this environmental space, I was fortunate enough to be invited by Steve Parrish, who's probably Australia's foremost photographer, to a weekend masterclass of his up in Queensland, up in Sunshine Coast area. Yes. And that was quite transformational for me, what he does with his photography work, publishing as well. So all about nature communication, and he speaks of a creative life purpose. So having this goal you're working towards throughout all of your endeavours, whatever they may be, and just following that, sticking to it no matter what. So that very much led me to where I am today with this life goal of mine, trying to reframe the human relationship with nature. And it's very high level, it's very ambitious, but that's what everything I do essentially is geared towards. So he was definitely an influence on me. Currently I'm being supported, mentored by a producer at the BBC, so I'd like to move into wildlife filmmaking, so that's a really good connection for me to make. Also, Daniel Fox, who's an American author, photographer, a speaker. So, yeah, I've got a lovely support network of people who appreciate, who want to assist me in what I do. And I've been very, very fortunate to gain their insight, their wisdom over the years.
Fantastic. So I'm curious, as a young man, Did you approach these mentors in the first instance, or how did that process work for you?
Yeah, I think so. In almost every case, I would have approached them. I found, as I'm a born introvert, I don't naturally take to reaching out to people, to connecting, sharing ideas, offering or asking for help even. So it wasn't a natural process for me. It's something I definitely struggled with early on. I think it's been a real learning point for me, past that learning curve, being able to communicate effectively, to reach out to people, not to be afraid of asking for help. Generally, people are very kind, very willing to assist in any way they can. But yes, I would have reached out to them at various points for various matters, and somehow that connection continued on, that relationship formed, and I continue to be in touch with them.
Fantastic. So just thinking on Steve Parrish's work, and I actually have some of his books, and his photography is breathtakingly beautiful. And so being mentored by Steve, has that helped you develop not only your photography, but your ideas around what you want to do with your nature filming and photography?
Very much so, yeah. So, I mean, if you look beyond that point, before I had that experience, and perhaps what my future plans, if any, I had at that point, may have been, it would have been much more aligned around conservation in the purest sense. So running my charity, I guess, is a part of that. And I've always done plenty of environmental volunteering. But that sort of showed me, I guess, the power of photography and videography as well, so filmmaking, all of these mediums for storytelling, for communication, and for raising awareness ultimately about animals, about environmental issues. So it's really opened my eyes. And everything that's happened in my journey since is equally so. But it's shown me the power of those mediums for awakening that interest in the global community, achieving my life's goal. And it's definitely led me down this life path, and hopefully that will continue in the future.
So Elliot, you describe yourself as a skilled communicator, senior management executive, and policy strategist, all at the age of 17. That makes you pretty special. So I'm
love what I do.
I'm wondering, with those inherent skills that you already have, after you've finished school, do you think university is the next path for you, or are you going to just continue doing what you do now?
It's a good question, and maybe 6 months ago I might have been able to give you a straight answer before COVID hit. So certainly the intention was to take a gap year, to be able to travel, great nature projects, devote a large chunk of time to that, hopefully meet some of those national teams in person, so connect on a more personal basis with those leaders I've been Skyping or Zooming, and ultimately to gain experience, further experience in wildlife filmmaking, so to start taking real strides down that path.
Been
lucky in view of that, in view of having such a chunk of time thus far, I've been able to collect some skills, some experiences in that life, but hoping to learn more about that. So COVID dependent, I'll still try and follow as much of that as I can, try and get out, see the world if possible, but otherwise I think I'll definitely take the year off, maybe do some filmmaking in Australia, who knows.
Good.
Looking at a project which is a short documentary series about animal rescuing, animal caring. So that would be amazing if I can get support for that, that goes ahead. And projects like that will definitely keep me going. I think I'm naturally drawn to ideas like that, to communicating, sharing my passion for nature. So I think that's the end goal.
Fantastic. I'm very glad to hear that even without COVID that you were thinking of taking a gap year. I think that that's an important step for young adults after so much intense schooling for that length of time. I want to mention to our listeners today that you have already done a TEDx talk. And for people who want to see that TEDx talk, which is really very good, I'm going to promote Elliot's website, which is elliotconner.com. And you'll be able to see his TED talk there. And so your vision of the future is a really wonderful vision. So I want you to tell the listeners what that vision looks like.
Yeah, so I express, I guess, my philosophy, my worldview with the term human nature. I like to think that if we can reform how we interact with other animals, how we view ourselves, our place on this planet, then we can change quite a lot about the current state of things, the status quo we live in. So, the TED Talk is a great example, sharing within that. It was five rules of evolution and how we can use those as a standpoint to guide our progress, our subsequent actions as a human species.
Yeah.
But essentially, what I'm trying to get across is that humans are animals. If we can look at ourselves as such, and if we can then do the flip side and appreciate the personalities, characters, these wonderful of animals who we're surrounded by, then that will ultimately create this new human nature, this world in which I think I and many others would love to live in. So I've recently been writing a book about it, hopefully published later this year.
Yeah.
And that is looking at some of the past, some of the history behind how we've interacted with other animals, how we're doing so currently, but then extending that into what it might look like in the future. Because conservation is only maybe 50 years old. It's a very new concept if you look at it. And everything we've achieved in those few decades is quite incredible.
Yes.
There's been a real shift in thinking.
I was fascinated.
Paradigm of sustainable development.
I've never thought of conservation as being a relatively young concept, but when you mentioned this morning that it is so young, so there is a ways to go for humanity in terms of conservation. So the future does look bright, doesn't it?
Yeah, I hope so. I think so. I think you have to believe that to do the line of work that I do. You have to believe that you can change the world, that things are going to turn out for the better. But I do believe it, honestly. I think if we can create some ambitious standpoints, some goals to work towards, say if we can get, for example, 50% of Earth's lands and oceans protected by 2050, this Half Earth project, then that will safeguard about 85% of all species, a significant proportion from extinction, from these widespread biodiversity declines. If we can, as I mentioned, introduce some ways of appreciating nature, of respecting it, if we can impose or accept the rights of nature, so allow animals standing, if you will, some rights, some voice in our society, all important. But ultimately it's about changing our perspective, aiming towards human nature standpoint. If we can achieve that, if we can get folks to realise that, then I think much else will follow.
Now, just for those listening and watching, you have that lovely accent. So you're originally from Leicestershire in the UK. And so how did you end up in Australia?
Oh, I think that was the family's move. So my parents both worked my father's business in leadership coaching. There was some flexibility. My mother works from home. My dad is traveling most of the time. So I think it was the way of life, the quality of life, which drew them out here. I've got many when I was very young. I moved out here from when I was five.
Yeah.
But Yeah, I've loved it out here. I think Sydney's a wonderful city. Beautiful, yes. Beautiful green place. Plenty of wildlife to be immersed in, to appreciate. So it's been a great move for me, even if Britain might be that heartland of conservation. I think it's got to be done here in Australia.
Yes, yes. Elliot, we talked this morning about Australia's really bad reputation around preserving some of our very unique flora and fauna. And I'm really glad that you do call Australia home, because we need more people like you helping to protect our unique environment. It's like no other country on the world, and our animals are incredibly unique. And knowing that you are here and will keep up and make sure that we look after our environment here in Australia is a wonderful thing. So we also talked this morning about your that lovely encounter with a leopard in South Africa. And so I'd love you to tell our BBS listeners about the leopard story.
Yeah, sure. So, I guess this is what sent me down the path I'm coming down in many ways. It sent me on this life journey of mine. But when I was 10 years old, I was camping with my family in northern Botswana. So I'd taken the term off school, and we were road tripping around several of the countries in southern Africa. And I was walking back from the campsite toilet. It was an open campsite, so no fences, no nothing. All the animals could wander through. And I was lagging behind my family, I think, slightly. So I was just at that age where I think you're starting to learn your independence. So I was maybe 2-3 meters behind everyone else, appreciating the stars, nightlife, the sounds of the bush. And just as we reached the edge of our campground, so the fire circle, I had this thick sense. I sort of turned around, and there, about 2 meters behind me, was a young leopard out stalking, so low to the ground. It's one of those moments you never forget.
Yeah. And I remember you telling me that you weren't afraid in that moment.
No, I don't think so. I think when you're in such a situation, it's so much the case that sort of time slows down. You think about everything very rationally. Obviously, it's an ambush predator, a leopard, so once you've seen it, once it's been noted, observed, it's not going to go and attack you. That'd be foolish. I think I looked into its eyes for several seconds, and then it turned away. I think that connection meant a lot to me. Leopards are still some of my favourite animals. And it just taught me, I think, the problems with the current system. So that leopard had almost certainly been fed by prior campers. It had grown accustomed to associating humans with food. And that had led it to become this issue. So threatening campers potentially. Things grew out of hand. It was most likely relocated or shot, which is terrible because it's not the leopard's fault, of course.
Yeah.
But it very much opened my eyes to the world at large, to this whole conservation dialogue.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Elliot, being that you are in senior high school still, I'm wondering how you manage being the CEO of Human Nature Projects and all the things that you do with schooling.
I think you have to love what you do. You have to live it as a lifestyle. But it is a juggle at times. So I've got my trial exams coming up in about a week, just over perhaps. So you're always busy. There's always things to do. You have to be very on top of it. Organized. Ultimately, it ends up with my working long days, long hours to fit it all in. I typically do sort of 5 to 9. At the desk or at school, whichever one it is, so juggling that day job, if you will, with my other pursuits and human nature projects, and other organisations I work with, all equally demanding. But it's not an easy lifestyle. I think that's perhaps why the system's not designed for 17-year-old charity founders or equivalent.
No.
It's not a common pursuit, but I love what I do. I think it's amazing that the community we've built around human nature projects. So that very much keeps me going day in, day out.
Elliot, do you have help with running the human nature projects, or is it just all you?
So I've got an international executive committee, which I head up.
Fantastic.
About half a dozen, senior staff, volunteers themselves, obviously, just as I am, who are giving up their time to coordinate all of this. And then, of course, all of our national teams, so those regional collectives of volunteers are sort of semi-independent. They manage to have their own internal inflows, messaging, activities, whatever it might be.
Yes.
So I coordinate with them on a regular basis, that a collective of volunteers, and between those two groups, that pretty much takes some of the workload off me, which is good. I think it's brilliant how it's set up, that sort of decentralized system, flattened hierarchy, if you will, which allows me to take some of the burden off.
Yes. And I didn't ask you this morning, but I thought after our earlier morning interview, what do your friends think about what you do?
Oh, good question. I'm not sure I know, to be perfectly honest.
Okay.
I think.
Do they know what you do?
They are much more sensitized to these issues. They do appreciate the state of our planet, the state of the environment.
Yes.
So I think on the whole, they're supportive. It's probably a bit up in the air also above them with school concerns, academics and such. But I enjoy it. I think school for me is more of a break from all of that. So I don't talk about it much. I mostly enjoy having that change. They say a change is good as a rest.
Yes.
So that's 6 hours of a working day taken out as that sort of rest, if you will, going to school in the academic life. And I enjoy learning. I love school life equally as much.
Yes.
But I try to keep the two fairly separate.
Fair enough. Understandable. And what about mum and dad? I bet they're pretty proud of what you do.
I think, as you mentioned, I come from that British background. So they do have bird watching, the outdoor activities and the culture.
Yeah.
And that's obviously led them to have some of interest in environmental matters, partially as a result of my activities. I think it's a journey for the entire family to go down as I've taken this path. But they definitely appreciate what I'm up to, what I do. There's a wonderful moment that happened very early on in the piece. Maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks in. And I was at that stage where I was very much growing operations, building this community. So I was counting down countries each day as they joined the network. I'd just been speaking with a person called Justice Enkoto. So he is now the National Director of Human Nature Projects in Lesotho. And his background was in HR for the Lesotho Olympic Committee.
Yes.
I walked into dinner, I believe, and said, I said precisely this, I've been speaking with the a member of the Lesotho Olympic Committee. A wonderful silence for maybe 10 seconds. it's been a journey for them just as much as for myself. Following the progress of the organisation as it's expanded, scaled so rapidly.
And
I wouldn't have believed it 12 months ago when I started that
I know.
We got this far, that we would have so many countries involved. It's definitely an exhilarating feeling to be behind all
that. I'll bet.
Be at the front of this network. And yeah, I think they definitely appreciate it all.
Yeah. And so we had a bit of a conversation this morning about leadership across the world. And I really loved your thoughts on current leadership across the world. So tell me, what are those thoughts again?
Yeah, I think world leadership is very mixed when it comes to environmental issues.
Yes.
In the US, I think we could do with some more work. Equally so in Australia. I mentioned, I think earlier, they've got second and third most threatened species of any countries. So
I know.
Plenty of work to be done in that respect. Yes. And I think part of the issue is that sustainable development, if you will, or development itself is quite disconnected from some of these environmental concerns.
Yes.
I was recently doing some research on how they correlate. So the Human Development Index, other metrics, so GDP, GNI, and correlating those with, say, threatened species or how they're progressing on environmental metrics. And there's no correlation whatsoever, or sometimes there's a negative correlation. So more developed countries are doing worse, which is not what we would hope for. We would hope as we progress, as we improve our quality of life, then that would improve that too. Sadly, not the case. So yeah, I think that's where Human Nature Projects comes in. And I mentioned earlier on the prior interview about countries like New Zealand. So Jacinda Ardern has recently added an element to their legal system, to their constitution, which recognises that animals are conscious beings. They are able to think, feel, understand themselves. And that's quite significant where these laws are concerned. It means animals have much more rights, much more of a say in our society, which is a wonderful step forward. Switzerland do a similar thing. They've got a clause which states that animals and plants must be treated with dignity, which is this wonderful sentiment. In the news, you might have seen a few weeks ago, I think, there was a concert done in a large classical opera hall in Europe. I think it was in Boulogne, but that might be wrong. But anyway, it was a string quartet, I believe, playing to a concert of 2,300 potted plants. Wonderful concept, it's a wonderful idea. Of course, it's because they can't have an audience in there, so they ended up live streaming this globally.
Yes.
Just having that as an idea and everything that it might mean, it's come to mean, it's incredible, I think, if we can give animals and plants that sort of treatment, then it will be fascinating to see what the end point we reach is.
Well, there is research around that interaction between music and plants and music and animals. There's a lot of research around milking cows in particular and classical music. And I think I remember reading about research into animal healing and its relationship to music. So there is that information out there, but a lot of people probably don't actually take the time to think about what that means in the way that we live our lives and the way that we interact with other beings on this planet, which leads to all the important work that you do, Elliot. So for such a young man, you've got your whole life ahead of you. What are some of the things that you would like to see across the world in the next 10 to 15 years? What would be the most important things for you to see on our planet?
Yeah, well, difficult question, definitely. Mm. 2020 was meant to be this biodiversity super year. So it meant to result in a new issue skulls and you slide forward for the field, plenty of major conferences, major gatherings of world leaders. COVID has put a full stop on
decimated everything.
All of that. So, yeah, I think some of it will be carried over to 2021, but it is going to be difficult to rebuild some of that momentum. It's definitely been a challenge for everyone, no matter how they're working, to overcome. In 10, 15 years, it's hard to say what change I'd like to see, what change we might be able to make. I think I'm often a high-level thinker. I'm looking at what I can achieve in my lifetime or what I can achieve by 2050 or similar goals. But what I'd love to see is I'd love to see animals given rights, rights for nature. That's a hot topic at the moment. How that comes about, whether we can recognise that with our current legal system, it should be certainly possible. And we've seen some wonderful examples, again, in New Zealand, a world leader, and many South American countries as well, typically led by indigenous groups, those sort of dialogues. But I'd love to see more of that. I'd love to see more research into the way animals think and behave. We've seen over the past century, if you will, a gradual dawning of understanding amongst researchers that they're doing it all wrong. So there's a wonderful story I like to tell of research done on an elephant. It was meant to test toys. So before Jane Goodall, before some of these myths were dispelled, there was a predominant belief that humans were the only animals that could use tools. So a study was done on this elephant in which it was provided with long sticks, like a broom handle, and a bunch of bananas on a shelf just out of its reach. The presumption being, of course, that it would use this stick, hold it in its trunk, to knock down the bananas and its lunch, get its reward. But that neglects to understand that elephants are heavily, heavily reliant on their trunks for their sense of smell. So a comparison would be if you had your eyes on your hands and you use that to pick up objects. It's, it's not something you do. But because the elephant failed to exhibit this behavior, it was assumed they were unintelligent. They couldn't exhibit tool use. And there's many, many other examples besides. But in this past decade, we've seen much of those methods improved upon, abolished, reverted to a much more effective means. If we, if we try and see this change in the scientific community, what it will be like in a decade, two decades' time, I think it will be dramatically different how we go about looking at other animals, if we can look at them from a more human standpoint, and whatever realizations might follow, I think will be quite transformational.
Elliot, in practical terms, if you think about conservation in terms of developments, and I'm talking housing developments, for example, should we be getting to the place where when those development applications are presented to local council or state government, that one of the principal considerations is the flora and fauna that it affects? Is that something that you would say would have
a question? Well, I think it goes back to that central debate we're working with in environmentalism itself. That clash, if you will, between development, economy, human advancement, and protecting our ecosystems. So I do think we need to find a middle ground. I mentioned it.
I agree.
50% land and oceans protected. That would be, I mean, it's widely agreed upon by the scientific community as that point we need to reach wherein we can continue to develop, to use those resources, to live our lives out as humans in the 21st century without having such great impact on animals. And it's not that huge a goal to realise currently.
I agree.
Which is protected. So it's going to be a step up, certainly. But
yes,
much of that land obviously isn't urban centres. We're looking at these biodiversity hotspots, which
yeah,
are still very much those unblemished lands where
yes,
human impacts perhaps aren't so great. So
like the Amazon.
It will take some willpower, some technology to achieve, but we definitely can.
Yeah. I agree with you, Elliot. I think that we have a unique opportunity to start to drive that conversation around how do we live together with animals and environment in a way that allows human interaction and we stop decimating the planet for the sake of development. And in particular, I'll just use the housing example. So it's about looking at it's a looking at how we live and do we need huge big houses and will that new housing development knock out koala populations? And that's an important consideration, isn't it?
Oh, certainly. No, very much so. I think if we can redesign how we live our lives, even so, if we
yes,
can accept human nature, start appreciating yes, other animals, then even with those housing concerns, you've got nature being respected, being given its time, its space across that property even. So
yes,
that does negate, I think, some of the issues around development if people are aware, conscious of those issues. And
yeah,
ultimately, I think the success of conservation relies on community goodwill. So the
yes,
the desire of the people to see things improve, if we can
yeah,
secure that, then I don't think development is an issue at all.
Yeah, yeah, no, I agree with you. For someone so young, you are highly motivated, Elliot, and passionate about conservation. What are some things that keep you motivated? Because you have a lot on your plate for one so young. So what sort of things keep you motivated, and what sort of things do you do that gives you a break? I know we spoke about school, but what other things that yeah, you do that keep you motivated and fill up your own cup is what I'm wanting to discuss. Yeah.
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier I love
yeah,
working with other passionate young people especially.
Yes,
so that definitely motivates me. And the community around human nature projects, the support network, those mentors I mentioned at the start of the call.
Yes.
So having those to fall back on certainly helps.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately you go into the line of work I'm in because you love it. There's no
yes,
money in conservation. I do everything I do on a strictly voluntary basis. I mentioned moving into wildlife filmmaking.
Yes.
I see that as the most effective means of living this
yeah,
lifestyle and continuing to tread this life journey of mine, push forward this life's purpose. So
yes,
I think it's ultimately coming back to that connection with animals, that connection with nature. And
yeah,
for me, I've been very lucky, very privileged to have some wonderful experiences. Just before I started
yeah,
Human Nature, I was volunteering at a bird of prey and hedgehog rescue centre in southern France. And there's
yeah,
a moment which really clearly stands out in my mind when I was doing a vulture release, so a grizzly
yes,
vulture, in the French Alps, so the Ardennes region. And we opened up the cage. You keep birds in dog kennels for transportation. So we'd opened this door
yes,
wide and flown out. Just seeing it join with several dozen other vultures flying, circling
yeah,
over a late afternoon,
yeah,
so the sunlight flashing off their wingtips on this
yes,
canyon, on this crevasse. It was one of those experiences which burned itself
yes,
into my mind. They were doing
yeah,
vulture research there, so they leave out sheep's carcasses and they monitor
yes,
the populations. So hence this gathering, this huge gathering of these birds, but simply magnificent sight.
Yes.
I remember thinking to myself at the time, what if everyone can experience this?
Because yes,
that's something yes. you don't forget. That's life-changing.
It is, isn't it? Elliot, how cute are baby hedgehogs? Are they absolutely as cute as they look?
Definitely, definitely. The challenge is picking up the adults. That requires practice. Have to stroke them. You stroke them first and then grab them. So you've got to find space in the right way. It's much harder with echidnas. That doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah.
Firstly, because they're larger, and secondly, because their spines aren't so flattened. The challenge is when you're trying to pick up an echidna and they can dig themselves in very strongly.
Those little balls that they roll themselves into, you can't get to them.
It's a wonderful survival strategy.
Yeah.
It really works.
Yeah. And those spikes, they are nasty.
Yeah. No, they're proper defence tools. I remember a case where I actually had to call for a spade doing an animal rescue just to dig. It's obviously a week, it's an injured echidna, and it still managed to dig itself in properly. But getting that leverage on it, they're incredibly strong. It's like,
aren't they?
Like you imagine a chimpanzee or a great ape, or one of our ancestors, but much, much stronger than the human itself.
Yeah. Incredible. Who is the most famous conservationist that you've met so far?
I've been lucky to speak with Jane Goodall. I think she's an amazing woman. What she's done in changing all of these dialogues around what humanity is as a species.
Yes.
Whether we're better than other animals, dispelling that myth I mentioned of toys.
Yes.
The work she did with Jim Sengombe is extraordinary. She managed to completely reform all of those dialogues. So she's certainly someone I look up to and someone I've been privileged enough to speak with on several occasions. I think environmentalism itself is lacking somewhat in those hero figures, those torch bearers you look up to. So there definitely needs to be a new generation coming through.
Because, you know, everyone knows David Attenborough. I want Elliot Connor to be the David Attenborough of the next generation. How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, I'd love to go into wildlife filmmaking, presenting, especially, so storytelling, be able to share about other animals and how they live out their lives.
Yeah.
I think it's extraordinary, what has done with effectively creating this genre in wildlife filmmaking, nature documentaries. He's defined the format, defined the style, and brought out a whole generation of environmental just as this field was emerging. So I think if we can carry on some of that work, bring it into the modern day and age, revolutionise it.
Yes.
So I think that would be the goal, to take on some of that burden, pass on the torch, if you will, Goodall and the likes. Because that's definitely the hope.
That filmmaking is a way into the hearts of millions of people to be able to watch the dance of those tiny colourful spiders and to be able to see a mother orangutan play with her baby. Those things we need to see on a regular basis so that our knowledge and our education and our thoughts about our environment outside of humans becomes more part of our psyche and further part of what we do to protect animals across the planet. So
definitely, I think it's quite revolutionary what you can do with wildlife filmmaking.
Yes.
If we can use that to force for good, then it will be really, really powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the other things that I wanted to ask you about was, do you see yourself absolutely doing this for forever. You don't see any other course that you will follow?
I definitely continue down this trajectory. I mentioned wildlife filmmaking, conservation itself, to it. Very closely connected. Both of those paths are very much in the future.
Good.
For that gap year or fall thereafter. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
It's
what I've lived my life out doing these past 17 years, connecting with other animals, raising stick insects, raising assassin bugs, raising bearded dragons, connecting with all sorts of animals in the wildlife rescuing now, I think.
Yeah. I was going to try and
about
catch
the dull effect.
I was going to try and get back to your wildlife carer role.
You don't turn off. Yeah. No, it's been an amazing journey for me doing that. I've been trained up only for the past 8 months, 9 months.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I mean, as a wildlife carer, you get to see the best and worst of it.
So
you get to see these wonderful, wonderful community members, concerned members of the public ringing in, reporting the wildlife.
Yeah.
With almost no knowledge about the animals themselves, but with dedication, this desire to see them healed. And there's some wonderful stories I can relate of them standing out for hours and hours in the cold, sheltering this animal, which they found on the footpath or what have you.
Yes.
That's inspiring for me. And seeing the animals recover, obviously, is again another wonderful journey. And there was a case recently, a sea turtle, which had been called up. And I remember spending nigh on an hour sitting with it.
Yes.
How on my lap, watching the sunset,
and
monitoring it, seeing how it fed. We kept it overnight, monitored its recovery. But that's one of those experiences. Incredible animal. So it's rewarding. It can be challenging. So that sea turtle didn't make it, and half the animals perhaps do. So you very much do have to live through both these times.
Yeah.
Frequently held animals through their dying breaths.
Stays
with you.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah, that they always stay with you, those moments. Have you had the opportunity to care for some of our more well-known local animals like koalas, wallabies? Or is it more the smaller ones that you get to look after?
I mostly do birds, so I'm a bird person. I love all animals. I started with insects, now lots of birds. But occasionally, various bits and pieces. So I've done a pygmy possum. Variously.
Possums are good.
They're very, very cute. But I'm mostly a bird person, so it's only the occasional exceptional case like that sea turtle was an exception. I haven't managed to do a koala yet. That's on the bucket list. Good fun. I imagine there was a few during the bushfires, but unfortunately, I was away. I was in South Africa while that was going on, doing some filming.
Which
work.
That's possibly lucky so that you were.
There were the positives to that story as well. But I definitely look to expand that in future. I love doing caring work. As I mentioned on the earlier show today, hoping to do a TV series, so a documentary series on the wonderful work these rescuers do. I think it's so underappreciated. The extent they go through, often they're retired people who devote their entire life to caring for these menageries of animals. They've got in their gardens, in their backyards, and working hour upon hour and spending most of their day just doing this cleaning, this feeding, whatever it is that comes up. So that would be wonderful if I can tell their stories.
Yes. I used to have lots and lots of beautiful finches, and I remember hand rearing baby finches straight out of the egg without feathers or anything when they'd been abandoned by their mother. Now, I have to say that I didn't always have the best success, But I can tell you, when you do have that success where you've been up feeding them every 2 hours from a dropper for the first 2 weeks of their life, and then they start to get their feathers and then they fly and fly on and off your shoulder, it's pretty fantastic, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, you're right. When you've got the baby birds, it's a full-time occupation.
And it is.
Watching them take on that journey to grow, develop, those are some of the most memorable cases.
Yeah, a lot of keeps through, so seeing
them attain their adult plumage and develop their character. Charismatic.
And they do have character. Like they have the tiny finch has a character that's different from anything else. They're all very unique. Elliot, we are just about out of time and I don't want to let you go off the program before we tell our listeners where to find you. So elliotconnor.com, elliotconnor.com. Now, Elliot's website is fantastic. And I know I mentioned this morning, but I love the little test yourself section on the right-hand side of his website. And it's filled with all the information about all of Elliot's wonderful work around human nature projects, where the projects are, what they're doing, how you can connect with him, and lots of fabulous photos as well. And Elliot, I really appreciate you taking the time to be on Radio Tony, and I'm grateful that you were able to do this, and I'm sorry that it's in your school holidays and I've taken up a fair proportion of your day, but it's been a rare delight to talk to such an inspirational young person and to know that at least from a conservation and animal perspective, as long as we have Elliot in the world is in good hands. So Elliot, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. And is there something that you'd like to leave the audience with today?
I think only that we need to see the humanity, the personalities of other animals. I think that's the one most important thing about everything I'm trying to promote, that I'm working towards. Just because you mentioned it on the website, have you looked at the test, which is a memory test that's given to chimpanzees? Yes. So the listeners should definitely try that out.
Absolutely.
Won't be able to match the chimpanzee at it.
Yeah. Fantastic fun it is. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are completely out of time. Once again, thank you to the amazing Elliot Connor, the CEO of Human Nature Products, and you need to watch out for this young man as he sets about changing the world for us. So thank you, Elliot, and thank you everyone for listening this week. Over to you, Don. Thank you for watching and listening to Tony TV. For more inspirational stories, join us next week. Bye for now.